friends. Isn't it fascinating how relationships bring us immense joy, but also profound heartache? They're a dance of emotions, yet how often do we truly, deeply, consciously invest in the relationship we have with ourselves and loved ones? That investment, that time, and that energy is the most powerful gift you could ever bestow upon yourself and those you love. As life didn't give us a manual on handling emotions and communication challenges, we also weren't taught the art of building romantic ties or how to deeply love and value ourselves. But I'm here to share more life-affirming, relationship-enhancing wisdom with you all. And now you can also find this transformational content pouring onto Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Dive into the show notes to connect with all the magic. Here's to growth, love, and endless learning.
Hi, and welcome. I'm so happy you're here. My name is Nicola Beer, and I'm going to be talking today about understanding and healing self-abandonment so that you can have a more loving relationship with yourself and then others. In the previous episode, part one of this two-part series, I spoke about how abandonment wounds from childhood or adult relationship experiences that are hurtful can lead to compulsive self-abandonment habits. These habits are so deeply ingrained because nothing is more troublesome and hurtful than being rejected, feeling neglected, betrayed, discarded, abandoned by a parent or a romantic lover or someone that was a good friend to you or another family member. That relationship pain can go so deep that we develop coping mechanisms in order to cope with that pain of abandonment. And then we fear abandonment, so we develop these compulsive habits to protect ourselves. They start off as a way to help ourselves. However, as they carry on throughout our lives, they end up in us abandoning ourselves. So it's a wound that we've been hurt by in relationship with others. And then we continue that pattern by abandoning ourselves. And we're not deliberately, intentionally, consciously abandoning ourselves. It's, as I mentioned, coping mechanism to cope with it. So in the previous episode, we talked about compulsive shame. We talked about compulsive numbing and escaping, compulsive caretaking, compulsive self-reliance. These are all strategies that a person adopts in a way to not feel the fear of others abandoning us or the fear that we could be hurt in relationships. And so today I'm going to talk to you about another six self-abandonment traits and give you some tips to support you to free yourself from them so that you can live your best life and have thriving relationships. The six I'm going to talk about today are compulsive perfectionism, compulsive distrusting everyone, compulsive hypervigilance, so that hyper alert, hyper aware of everything, where you're not relaxed, you're sort of scanning everything, compulsive self-dysregulation, and I'll talk to you what that means, compulsive disassociation and maladaptive daydreaming, and then compulsively choosing unavailable people, compulsively choosing unhealthy relationship patterns. So let's dive straight into compulsive perfectionism. This can be a really difficult trait for those who have experienced abandonment. It's particularly prevalent among those who have experienced that childhood trauma, where the underlying belief here is that perfection will prevent them being abandoned. Perfection will lead to keeping that attachment. The thought process is, if I'm perfect, if I get everything right, I won't be left. My needs will be met. I'll be looked after. This mindset leads to the development of an internal and external critic, as described by Peter Walker in his book on complex PTSD. This critic constantly reminds you to be perfect, warning you against making mistakes with the belief that perfection equates to being loved. However, the pursuit of perfection is an illusion, as true perfection doesn't exist. We are all perfectly imperfect. That's what it is to be human, to be imperfect. Anna, who grew up in a home where high achievement was highly valued, not only believed that her worth and affection that she received from her parents were directly linked to her achievements, her mother actually openly stated this to her. She told her that she needed to look a certain way, act a certain way when they were entertaining guests. Both her mother and her aunts used to comment on the way that she was dressed, make sure that she was looking smart enough. When she was a teenager, they made horrible comments about her acne and shamed her. So it wasn't just about her academic achievements that she felt she had to be perfect because this is what made her mum happy or unhappy. It was also the way that she looked and presented herself, as well as for her father, how she was achieving in sports because he was really into sports. As an adult, she found herself highly critical of the way that she looked, the way that she acted in social settings. She would often beat herself up, telling herself that she shouldn't have said this or she shouldn't have said that or she should have done that or she could have worn this, constantly doubting and questioning herself. She was living in a constant state of stress, striving for perfection in her career as well. And then in her relationship and personal life, she was difficult to live with. And that's her own words. She wanted perfection everywhere in her life. She'd get very irritated if things were out of place. When she was entertaining herself, she'd go through huge anxiety, often wouldn't enjoy the events, and would have sleepless nights before. This pursuit left her feeling exhausted. She never felt that she was good enough. She was always focusing on her shortcomings. She couldn't allow herself to enjoy her accomplishments. She motivated herself by saying, right, what next? Oh, you could have done this or you could have done that. She was so hard on herself that even though she had so much to be grateful for, it really wasn't worth it because she just felt empty, angry, and low. Overcoming compulsive perfectionism is possible. First, you need to recognize the illusion of perfection, understanding that perfection is unattainable and that striving for it sets you up for constant disappointment and self-criticism. To stop it, it's crucial to identify triggers, pinpoint situations where your perfectionist tendencies emerge most strongly. Is it at work, in relationships, or when dealing with personal goals? Is it from you or what others say to you? Then in those situations, practice self-compassion. Replace self-criticism with self-compassion by acknowledging your efforts and celebrating your achievements, no matter how small. I also recommend setting realistic goals. Aim for progress, not perfection. Set achievable goals and recognize that making mistakes is a natural part of learning and growing. Making mistakes is a human experience. We all do it. If you can't seem to break free from the grip of needing to be perfect, then therapy to help you remove that inner critic can be really powerful, especially therapy that works with the subconscious mind and that attachment energy, because we're attaching to perfectionism as a coping mechanism to protect us from that fear of being abandoned. So working through that, I normally use processes that work with the subconscious mind and the unconscious mind together as one that can really address these deep-seated perfectionist tendencies. And here are some other tips for you. You might want to keep a journal to document your thoughts and feelings, especially when the critic voice emerges. You may want to engage in activities that you enjoy without focusing on the outcome. This is a hobby where you can embrace imperfections, where you let go of that competitive side and you allow yourself to be new at something, to be a novice in some area, and allow that and celebrate that and laugh at yourself. Be okay with that. Also, I highly recommend surrounding yourself with supportive people who appreciate you for who you are, not what you achieve, what you've accomplished for you. When Anna signed up for my breakthrough program, we looked at all her perfectionist patterns and their origins. She started practicing different activities to be more present, and we listed and released all of her critical self-talk. And I also found a hobby in painting, an activity where she could embrace imperfections and enjoy the process rather than the outcome. By addressing compulsive perfectionism and learning to embrace imperfection, individuals can start to break free from unrealistic standards they've set for themselves. This shift allows for a more compassionate and fulfilling approach to life, where one's self-worth isn't contingent on being perfect. Shifting away from this can be life-changing, as compulsive perfectionism affects every area of a person's life, where you can become your own cheerleader, a best friend to yourself. You can really sail through life's challenges with confidence, peace, and fulfillment. To help you on your path to making this shift, I've created the Self-Empowerment Toolkit. It's a toolkit to guide you towards loving yourself and valuing yourself more. It has confidence meditations, ways to talk to yourself in a more positive, constructive way, a strengths inventory to recognize your strengths and achievements and accomplishments, a tool to help you change any negative beliefs into more positive beliefs, a visualization to guide you to loving yourself and seeing yourself in the best way possible, and so much more. It's absolutely free. I'll put the link along with my show notes, and it's also available on my website. Just go to nicolabeer.com, click on the gifts, and it'll be right there for you. The next compulsive behavior pattern that I want to talk about is compulsive distrust. This issue stems from deep-seated belief that due to past abandonment experiences, no one can be fully trusted or relied upon. It's an acceptance of a lonely reality, believing that in the end, we are fundamentally alone. Even those with a strong spiritual practice or belief system may feel this sense of solitude at some level. This distrust is not without reason. As human beings, we are inherently complex and imperfect. Luke, growing up, learned to be constantly on guard, as his caregivers were unpredictable and often let him down. As an adult, he found it hard to trust anyone, always expecting the worst. This hypervigilance was a survival tool in his childhood, but became a barrier in forming close relationships. Compulsive distrust is where you doubt people's intentions. You fear being cheated on. You fear people are talking behind your back or they don't like you. You fear others are against you in some way or that they don't like you. You find it hard to let go and fully trust. So in order to overcome this compulsive distrust, it's so important to first recognize the pattern, acknowledge how this distrust is rooted in past experiences and how it's affecting your current enjoyment of life, your current relationships. Start small. Begin by sharing small vulnerabilities with trusted individuals and observe how it feels when they respond positively. Challenge assumptions. Work on not entering every situation with the assumption that the worst will happen. Challenge those negative thoughts. Instead of thinking, well, those two are talking behind my back, or that person doesn't like me, or that person's done this because they are this way. Asking yourself, do I have any evidence? Is that really true? Calming yourself in that process. Also, trusting yourself. Focusing on building trust in your ability to handle whatever comes your way, regardless of others' actions. Getting support for this can really be invaluable, as our beliefs create our reality. And if you are believing that you can't trust different people, or you're scared to put yourself in situations, you're always going to be scanning for the worst thing to happen or seeing the worst in people. And then that really affects your closeness in relationships. And that doubt and that insecurity can actually drive people away. Those that you really do love and do want in your life can be hurt, be triggered themselves by you not trusting them. And then you can then reinforce that abandonment pattern, which so many people who come for the breakthrough and we clear all of these negative thoughts and beliefs realize is they realize that, wow, I'm getting to a point in my life where this distrusting everyone is actually pushing away the people that I love. I'm very insecure. I'm very jealous. I'm very overreactive. I'm negative. I don't like who I'm becoming. And when people go through periods of stress, like relationship challenges, changing a job, losing a job, moving countries, losing a loved one, dealing with unexpected health problems yourself or in those that you're close to, in these periods of stress, our compulsive self-abandonment patterns can become stronger. we may have that need to numb out more. We may become, in this case, more distrusting, more cautious, more wary of people. We can become more avoidant and push people out. We can act in irrational ways where we don't recognize ourselves. So if you've got to that level, then do get some support and realize that it's totally natural and normal to have these compulsive habits after being abandoned in our childhood or in previous romantic relationships or any close relationship. It's okay to ask for help. It's empowering asking for help because it's showing yourself that I'm worth it. I'm worth investing in. I'm worth putting money and time in feeling better about myself, in enjoying my life. I deserve to be happy and I deserve to be free of this negative thinking that can be so consuming. Here are some tips to help you. Reflect on past instances where someone has been trustworthy and supportive. Create a long list. Who has been trustworthy? Who is supportive in your life? Who can you trust? Practice self-affirmations and then reinforce your strength and resilience through repeating them to yourself or reading them. Set boundaries in relationships and observe how they are respected, which can build trust as well. Luke started therapy to work through his trust issues. He joined a local sports team, which provided a low-stakes environment to practice trusting others and working as a team. Gradually, he began to open up to friends, sharing more about his feelings and experiences. By working on trusting others a little more and sharing vulnerabilities in a controlled manner, individuals like Luke can learn to balance their need for self-protection with the need for human connection. Then from that, the next key is to build a strong foundation of self-trust and resilience, enabling you to navigate relationships with a healthier perspective. You trust yourself. When you trust yourself, you can face fear. You can allow people in. If they hurt you, of course, then you don't need to continue having them in your life in that way or in any way. When you trust yourself that no matter what happens, you're going to be okay, you can move forward and have thriving relationships, feeling more at ease and more comfortable with others, that your energy is drained and your enthusiasm for life, your vitality, your energy is kind of squashed. Compulsive hypervigilance is another state often developed in response to childhood environments where constant alertness was necessary for emotional or physical survival. Compulsive hypervigilance is like a reflex. Individuals who grew up in an unstable or unpredictable environment learn to constantly scan their surroundings for potential threats. This hypervigilance, though initially a protective mechanism, can become a chronic and toxic issue, causing stress and anxiety in adulthood. And the thing about this is you often don't realize that you're doing it. I have hypervigilance and it's got better and better over the years. Growing up for me, my mum was unstable. She was unsafe. Sometimes she would shout. Sometimes she would be calm. You never knew. My dad was pretty absent when he was there and went through periods of not being there. So you were always kind of on tender hooks. I remember going home and thinking, I hope mum's in a good mood today. I hope I'm not going to get shouted at. And because of this hypervigilance and because of what I went through, I also have what they called a startled shock. So if someone says hello or someone jumps you, you know, you're not expecting that person to be there, I will literally go, you know, like in a big exaggerated way. And that is also part of the experience of living in an environment where a parent was unpredictable. Now, this doesn't have to be just childhood. Hypervigilance can come from a traumatic experience. I've worked with people who have been kidnapped, who have been bullied at school or in adult life, who've had people threaten them, where they become hypervigilant. They're searching and scanning to know that they're safe. An example of this could be if someone's talking to you, you're listening to them, but then you're thinking at the same time, are they manipulating me? Are they true to their word? Where you're observing their behavior, where you are questioning things that you're told, where you're looking for exit points, And I know a lot of people in the forces and other places, they're trained to be hypervigilant. They're trained to scan. However, it can be so draining to be on this hyper alertness. One area that I am hypervigilant is in meeting new people, groups of people. I can sometimes sit back unknowingly. This is unconscious self-protective behavior. I'm very quiet. I sit back. I don't say anything. I'm listening to what everybody's saying. I'm getting a feel for their personality, their character. I just listen. I'm silent. And then a day later or after a few times, then I'll be comfortable to be my full self, let my full self out. So my self-protection is checking and assessing, are these people safe? Is it okay to be me? And it's really unconscious a lot of the time. Alex, for example, had hypervigilance. He was always on edge. He was trying to anticipate and avoid conflict in a tumultuous household. As an adult, he found himself constantly reading into people's facial expressions, tones of voice, and anticipating problems, even in safe environments. This constant state of alertness made it difficult for him to relax and trust others, impacting his relationships and overall well-being. Another lady that I worked with was constantly scared that her nanny and maid, that was a live-in nanny, was mistreating the children. And so she'd be looking for evidence. Everything they said, everything they did, she would be constantly worried about that happening. And then when they decided not to have a nanny, her hypervigilance and fears turned towards her husband. And then she started questioning, is he manipulating me? Does he have my best interests at heart? Is he using me? And that being used, that fear of being used in a relationship, I used to have that fear. And it came from my childhood because my mother was always saying how my dad used her and he did take a lot of her money and gamble her money. So, you know, she has every right to say that. And so this was all what was projected onto me that's going to happen in my relationships. And I used to fear, okay, men are going to use me. And then when I did the breakthrough process and did some deep therapy, I realized that the core of that issue was that I didn't feel I was lovable. Because I didn't feel I was worthy of love and lovable, I was looking for a reason why someone isn't really with me because they love me. There must be another reason why a man is with me. And that was such a good, profound, deep healing. And I actually got to that conclusion fairly quickly and easily in plant medicine therapy. And that's why I've now trained to work in plant medicine therapy, because with plant medicines, you can really go deep and clear those patterns. I never probably would have come to that conclusion. I was always in a relationship worried that someone was going to use me or they were with me for the wrong intentions because I didn't believe that I was lovable. And years of therapy that could have taken me to really understand that and to see my partner and all the great that he does, that he really, really does love me. And through, thankfully, that journey, I was able to see everything illuminated and that it's just this fear. So how do you overcome compulsive hypervigilance? First of all, you recognize the pattern. Acknowledging the hypervigilant behaviors and understanding their roots in past experiences can help you to connect that dots. However, you don't want to stay there. You know, traditional therapy can be cathartic. You talk about your past. You realize, okay, this behavior relates to my past childhood experiences. You talk. Does it shift? Often for a lot of people, no. They understand their behavior. They know and could probably write a full book on why they are the way that they are. However, they're still stuck in the same self-abandonment patterns. And that's why it's so important to get to the root of those self-abandonment patterns. I've got a breakthrough masterclass video on that, helps explain it further so that you can then find the right therapist, whether that's a plant medicine therapist or whether that's a therapist that works with the subconscious mind and the unconscious mind, one that uses actions and tools to help you get yourself out of self-abandonment, because you can't talk your way out of these deep self-abandonment patterns. You have to act your way out. You have to change the neural pathways in the brain to be free. And as I mentioned, my breakthrough masterclass video, again, I'll put the link along with the show notes, will help explain to you the patterns and the process that you need to do so that you can embark on that journey. Because there's nothing worse than understanding your problems, knowing them inside out, and then noticing that you're still doing them again and again and again. It can sometimes make things worse, being more aware and not having any tools to change them. Because then you can say to yourself, well, why aren't you changing that? You know that this is not how you want to be. Why are you still doing this behavior? And that's another key point. It's so important with all of this work to have self-compassion. It's okay that some of these self-abandonment traits are still going to be there and pop up on occasions. However, if they're really affecting your enjoyment of life, if they're coming up daily, if they're really damaging your relationships, or your self-esteem has plummeted or very low and it's stayed low, then it's time to take action and really help yourself to break free from these patterns. Nervous system regulation is another tip that can really help. Regulating your nervous system using deep breathing or progressive muscle relaxation is a really effective tool. And actually, in the self-empowerment toolkit, I give away a progressive muscle relaxation meditation. You can just listen to it, lie down, and go through that process to regulate and calm down your nervous system. Because when our bodies are calm, our mind then becomes calmer. And you can use this and the self-confidence meditation to calm yourself whenever you get triggered. Challenging your underlying beliefs, working on addressing and modifying the beliefs is really powerful as well. In fact, in the self-empowerment toolkit as well, I also give belief changing exercises. One's a deep hypnotherapy meditation where you lie there and go through that experience. And then the other is more of a step-by-step conscious guide where you work through the steps to change your beliefs. Both are very powerful. And then, of course, as I mentioned, therapy can really help, and creating safe spaces, developing environments where you feel secure and relaxed, which can then help counteract the need for that constant vigilance, because that constant vigilance is so draining for the mind and therefore the body. It can affect sleep, it can affect energy, it can affect how you interact with others, it can affect your enjoyment of life. So some tips, mindfulness practices that help you stay present, doing any activity where you're in the moment and you're not thinking about other things. Whether that's for some people playing video games and computer games, for others doing exercise like paddle tennis or something where you're just really engaged. I've just started horse riding. I can't ride yet. I'm just sort of sitting on the horse and occasionally allowing it to trot. But it's a new experience for me. I've never done that before. And I just love being out in nature with the horse energy. It's just a beautiful experience. Of course, children and animals, they can really help you be present and just enjoy focusing on one thing. Other people love painting and creative crafts. What can you do where you don't think about anything else? My other favorite is dancing. Dancing to good house music, or any music, actually. I'm quite open on any kind of dance music. I just love to dance. And when I listen to the music, I'm just away. My mind isn't racing. Sometimes I do get great, powerful, intuitive thoughts when I'm dancing. It's not that negative or anxious energy. It's just thinking about things in a calm way. And I really love, hope to dance as much as possible because it's really something that lifts me and frees me. Some people find comfort in establishing routines that promote a sense of safety and predictability. And as I mentioned before, self-compassion, acknowledging that your hypervigilance was a survival strategy. You have to do it in order to keep yourself safe. Alex started his journey to healing by attending therapy, where he learned about the impact of his childhood and his current state of hypervigilance. He began practicing mindfulness meditation and found it particularly helpful in managing anxiety in certain occasions. However, it wasn't until he did the deep work, the subconscious changing of beliefs and creating that sense of strength and safety in himself, did he feel truly empowered and safe to push himself out of his comfort zone, go and meet new people, try new activities and hobbies. That became his motto to live by, to just do things that tested his comfort. But he couldn't do that until we'd worked on that base of feeling secure and grounded first. he did decide that he wanted to create, as he was going through this process for the 3 months with me, to create a safe place within his office. So he asked his wife and his children to not come into his office, to only allow him to connect with them when he came out, so that he could really create this safe place. And this is where he did his meditations. He got a lovely cushion in the corner, some candles, his self-improvement, self-motivational books and things like that, created his vision board. And he had this safe place where he could learn and work on his trusting in himself. Dealing with compulsive hypervigilance involves understanding and addressing its roots and past experiences of instability or trauma. It's about learning to calm the body, to soothe the trauma, and gradually build a sense of safety in the present. Recognizing that hypervigilance was necessary for survival in the past, but not necessarily in the present, is key to the healing process. Now, hypervigilance can take many different forms. Some people aren't even aware that they're doing it. However, if you have constant doubts, if you are uncomfortable in new environments with the new people, if you find yourself questioning things, checking things, these can all be signs. So the next one I want to talk to you about is self-dysregulation, compulsive self-dysregulation. This refers to the inability to manage and regulate emotions effectively. This issue often arises from childhood experiences where survival was a primary focus, leaving little room for understanding and processing emotions. As a result, emotions can feel unpredictable and overwhelming. They can pop up unexpectedly and intensely. This lack of emotional regulation can manifest in various different ways. It can manifest as somatic responses, so that's physical symptoms resulting from the emotional stress. So some people that I work with, they have stomach aches, IBS, gas, intestine discomfort, and they carry that stress in their stomach. For other people, their emotions come out in their face. They have headaches, neck pains, feel achy all over, shoulders, back. It's where you're carrying those emotions, often repressed emotions, in the body, and you're feeling unwell. Migraines, I've worked with a lot of people to help them with them, and it's often emotional baggage that they're carrying, emotional stress. And when people feel depressed, when they can't sleep, when they can't eat properly, or they overeat, it's because they are stuffing down their emotions, and then they come up and surprise them, and they can be all-encompassing. You know, some people describe themselves as being really emotional, and this can sometimes relate to self-dysregulation, where they just can't regulate their emotions. They're overwhelming for them, or they can find other people's emotions overwhelming, and they may want to avoid other people's emotions, avoid conflict, run from it. Rachel grew up in a chaotic household where expressing emotions was discouraged. As an adult, she found her emotions hard to control. She would often experience sudden headaches and bouts of anxiety, seemingly out of nowhere. These reactions were her body's way of responding to unacknowledged and unregulated emotions. So Rachel had a lot of anger. It wasn't safe for her to express her anger because she would have got into trouble. Her father had a temper, a short fuse. So if she, as a child, expressed her healthy anger at situations, normal childhood things, she would be shouted at. She would feel scared. She would feel panicked. She would maybe get punished with being sent to her room or having to do chores or other forms of punishment. So she learned, I'm just going to stuff and keep my emotions down. And as an adult, she found herself also exploding at small situations. In her romantic relationships, she saw a side of herself that she didn't know was in her. When she got comfortable with that person, her anger was explosive. Her words were so hurtful because she was carrying a lot of this anger. Sarah, that I worked with, had an intense anxiety without an apparent cause. And this is another form of self-dysregulation. She didn't know where this anxiety was coming from. She woke up as a result of her childhood, where her parents were so busy and she was alone a lot. and she didn't know how to navigate the world. She was left alone to make her food and entertain herself after school. And so she grew up feeling anxious. And even as an adult, and even understanding all of this with therapy, okay, I had this childhood experience, it explains it. It didn't explain why she was feeling anxious as an adult, but she would just wake up some mornings and feel worry. Or she would, in the evening sometimes, watching a movie, all of a sudden she'd start feeling anxious and she wouldn't know why. She couldn't relate it to anything. And this highlights that unresolved emotions. So how to overcome self-dysregulation? First, understand your emotions. Begin by acknowledging and understanding your emotions, recognizing the signs of emotional dysregulation in your body. That's the first step. So break down, what are the different types of emotions? I'm feeling hurt, I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling resentful, betrayed, lonely, lost, confused, disappointed. You know, label them, understand them, and then look at, okay, how is this affecting you? I'm feeling tired. I'm feeling achy. I've got a headache. My stomach's unsettled. Recognize how these emotions are affecting your body. And then breathing techniques can also work well here. Just doing slow belly breathing, lying down, putting your hand on your stomach, and just to the count of four, breathing in, holding it for four, breathing out, holding it for four. Just doing like the pattern of four, 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 four. So you're breathing into the count of four, holding for the count of four, breathing out to the count of four, holding to the count of four, breathing into the count of four. Do that for 3 to 5 minutes. It's so calming. Because when we calm our body, we can calm our nervous system, which obviously then calms the mind and reduces immediate stress. I used to hate breathing exercises. When people used to say to me, oh, just do these breathing practices, I'd be like, oh God. But they actually really work. And I'd like that one because it's really simple and it's slow and it just takes a few minutes and you do actually feel great. Guided meditation, a lot of people like that. I tend to do guided meditations that are really deep. So if someone has got a bit of a scattered mind like me, I've got ADHD, it can sort of engage you and take you deeper. I'm not good with these kind of light meditations, talking things, because my mind will just go in 100 different places or it will irritate me. And as I mentioned in the self-empowerment toolkit, there's a few in there. So if you like guided meditations, or if the guided meditations that you're using, they're just not doing it for you because they're not deep enough, then do check that out. Also creating that calm space, dedicating a space in your home for relaxation and meditation where you can feel grounded and calm. And probably for all the parents out there listening to this, you're saying, no chance, Nicola, there's not going to be that place. Well, see if you can somehow create that place, even if it's going to your bed and lying down. And then other tips could be journaling. Some people find it useful to express and understand their emotions through journaling. Some people love to engage in regular physical activity, which can then release the pent-up emotional energy. I remember one time I was so angry because this person that I'd hired to help me design my house or make it look a bit better, I'm not very good at the visual stuff. So I was like, right, I'll get this person. And they were late 5 times before. And then this time they were late. And I had other people to fit in after. And I don't know if I'd eaten that day. I don't know. I was just so angry. And so I just thought, right, I need to get rid of this anger because it was horrible. It was just consuming me. I could just feel it everywhere in me. My face was red. And I was just like, I've got to get rid of this. So I decided, right, I'm just going to go out into the garden and just do a load of jumping jacks. And I just like probably looked like a right lunatic, but I was just like doing these jumping jacks. And after about 15 minutes, I was exhausted and I was just calm. It's like, it's okay, Nicola, it's not a big deal. Yes, it's annoying. Yes, you're not going to use this person again because they've consistently let you down. Yes, you can just change your other appointments. A month from now, it's not going to really bother you. So just calm down. I couldn't have done that until I'd got rid of that emotional energy. Some people find it really useful to scream into a pillow, go in their car and scream their heart out, punch a pillow, get out your emotions. Crying, of course, is great. Some people find it hard to cry, but they know that they need to cry. So sometimes if you are moved by movies and documentaries, sometimes I encourage some people to watch some of those and really allow themselves to get into that crying energy. And that can be a great form of release. And then just practicing any techniques that help you to be aware of the emotional triggers. So if you go through an episode where you're really triggered, then you probably can't in that moment pause and write it all down. But later, write it down on your phone, in a journal, and become aware, okay, I'm triggered by people being late, for example, or I'm triggered by incompetence, or I'm triggered by traffic, or I'm triggered by sad movies, or I'm triggered by people telling me what to do, or whatever it is. Rachel addressed her emotions by really expressing all of the emotions that she wasn't allowed to express as a child. We let them all come out. And we did, I don't know if you have aware of this technique, it's called empty chair technique, where you're talking to the parent. And can be a very cathartic process where you're saying and getting out what you needed to say as a child to that person. And I used to do this with people that are going through a breakup, and the things that they wish that they could say or the wish that they said, and they just need to get them out. So we use this chair and we say, right, imagine that that person is sat in that chair. If you could empty out everything, get it all off your chest, get it all out of your cells, what would you say to that other person? And just allowing them to express, because sometimes our emotions get trapped because we're not expressing what we need to express. And there we're struggling with it, we're carrying it, it's in us, and it needs that form of releasing. Learning to regulate emotions is a key step in healing from abandonment wounds. It involves understanding your emotional patterns, developing coping strategies, and seeking appropriate support. By doing so, you can learn to manage the intense emotions that arise and lead a more balanced and emotionally stable life. The next issue that I want to talk about in healing from abandonment wounds is compulsive disassociation, often accompanied by maladaptive daydreaming. This behavior involves mentally escaping from reality, a coping mechanism deeply ingrained in the body and nervous system. For many, this strategy was a means of survival during a difficult childhood, providing an escape through fantasizing or creating imaginative worlds. While such creativity can be advantageous, especially in artistic endeavors like novel writing or fiction, it can also become a way to avoid and escape from real life, leading to self-abandonment. This habit of disconnection can prevent individuals from experiencing and fulfilling their need for love, companionship, joy, or even anger. It's like creating an alternative reality in their mind, disconnected from what is felt in the body, and can result in a life that is not grounded in reality. Sophia grew up in a turbulent household where emotional expression was discouraged. To cope, she developed a rich inner world where everything was peaceful and perfect. As an adult, Sophia found herself daydreaming excessively, especially in stressful situations. This habit made it difficult for her to connect with others and address her real-life challenges. Compulsive disassociation and maladaptive daydreaming can cause difficulties in also romantic relationships, where a person tunes out and they're not present with their partner. They're not listening. I've had people come to me with this where they've completely been in a business meeting and not heard a word that was said. They're living in another world. The first step in overcoming this is to recognize the pattern. Acknowledge the pattern of disassociation and understand, where does it come from? What am I avoiding? Grounding techniques can really help as well. Grounding techniques bring you back to the present moment. It's kind of a short thing you can do. It can take like 1 minute to 5 minutes to 10 minutes. And it's sensory. So you're saying to yourself, right, I can feel my feet on the floor. I'm grounding to the earth. I can feel the back of my body to the back of the chair. I can feel the chair supporting me underneath my legs. That can be like one form of it. Or there's many other grounding techniques. I love earthing. I don't know if you've watched that documentary on YouTube about earthing. It's really interesting. And people, according to this documentary, get a lot of healing by connecting to the earth. So taking off your socks, taking off your trainers, putting your feet into the soil, walking on grass, laying on sand, connecting to Mother Earth. And that can be very grounding, very centering, and very calming. And can engage you in the present moment. Engaging in reality, sometimes it can help to push yourself to engage with the real world if you find yourself avoiding it. So doing some social activities, having those conversations, those that you love, if they notice that you do this and you really want to break that pattern, then you say to them, I'm not doing it on purpose and I really want to be present for you. I really want to give you that love and attention. So if I wander off, could you just gently put your hand on mine and gently just say, hello, are you there? Or put your hand on my knee and just shake it so I come back to you. Because often if we've got these self-abandonment patterns and we've been abandoned, the last thing we want to do is make those that we love, or anyone for that matter, feel uncomfortable, not feel good in our space. So here are some more tips for you if you recognize this pattern. This may sound counterproductive, but it can also help to set specific times for daydreaming, limiting it to a healthy level. It can help in engaging in activities that require focus and attention. It may even be worth checking whether you also have ADHD. I was always known as a daydreamer growing up. I'd walk into a lamppost, I'd ride my bike into a wall. My family would all joke and laugh about it. I was in a marching band and I was always out of step because I was just always in my own world. However, thankfully, as an adult, I managed to get out of that daydreaming. I've done a lot of therapy as well. So kind of limiting your daydreaming and engaging in activities that require focus. Also recommend keeping a diary of when you disassociate, what triggers it. Because the more you can become aware of the source, then the more you can deal with that source, and then you're going to be more present for life. Sophia began her journey by talking with me, creating that journal. We talked through the patterns and we realized that actually there were some really strong triggers that kept repeating themselves that was creating these disassociative patterns. And then we dealt with them, increased our confidence to be able to deal with them. She also started doing yoga and meditation, and this helped her to stay grounded in the present. She joined a book club, which provided her with social interaction and an opportunity to engage in a focused activity where she, you know, with reading, she had to focus. And it was difficult at first for her to read the books, and she progressed, and now she absolutely loves reading and she loves that social outlet. By addressing compulsive disassociation and maladaptive daydreaming, individuals can learn to stay connected with their real experiences and feelings, fostering a healthier relationship with themselves and the world around them. Because if you're not really present in your life, you're not living your life to the full. I hope that helps you if you are experiencing compulsive disassociation. The next and last one we're going to talk about today is the tendency to compulsively choose unavailable people or unhealthy relationships. This pattern involves repeatedly getting involved with individuals who, for various reasons, are not fully capable of meeting your emotional needs. It's a way of unconsciously recreating a familiar dynamic of childhood where emotional availability was lacking. Despite telling ourselves that each new relationship is different, really seeing it and believing it's different, often when we take a closer look or when we go through the experience, we can see that there is a consistent pattern. David had a series of relationships with partners who were emotionally distant or preoccupied with their own issues. He found himself drawn to people who needed rescuing, who needed fixing, who he could help. Upon reflection, he realized this pattern mirrored his childhood experiences, where he constantly sought approval and attention from a distant parent, where also he was left to look after his siblings and also help his parent emotionally rather than his parent helping him. Each of these romantic relationships in adulthood left him feeling unfulfilled and reinforced his belief that he was undeserving of a fully committed partner, that there was something wrong with him. There's nothing worse, is there, when you go through life and you get into that mindset where you're like, something wrong with me. It's not that there's something wrong with you. You've gone through some difficult experiences. And as a result of that, you learned how to cope with that by creating self-protective coping mechanisms. And they worked. They helped you as a child. It's just, as adults, often the coping mechanisms that we develop as children do not serve us. It does not serve us to push our emotions down, repress them. It doesn't serve us to be a people pleaser. It doesn't serve us to caretake for others. And in this habit, it doesn't serve us to believe that we don't deserve someone to be emotionally there for us, that we need to be in relationships with people that we can fix and we can help rather than receiving. So to overcome the pattern of choosing unavailable people, the first step is, as with all of these, acknowledging it, looking for the patterns, looking at your past relationships. What do they have in common? Are you only attracted to people with problems that don't have their stuff together? Are you attracted to people that are controlling and selfish, that don't express their emotions? Who are you attracted to? And how do their traits compare to your parents' traits? If you were to write down, okay, the things that I love about my partner, their traits, the things I don't love about my partner, their traits, and then you write down a list of all the traits of your parents, often people will find, and I've got a really powerful exercise I can give you to do this, they realize that, wow, these are the same. So that can be a really interesting, enlightening exercise to do. Then it's understanding, okay, the roots, where does it come from? And then pacing your relationships. Now, this is something that I haven't been very successful at. I must admit, it's learning. And that's by pacing your relationship, it's not rushing into relationships, taking time to get to know somebody. If you've gone through abandonment, it's likely that you'll want relationships to happen super fast or super slow. You'll either be completely avoidant and be like, no, that's a red flag. I'm going to avoid that relationship. And you take ages to connect and to let yourself go. Or the opposite, you love bomb, or you get love bombed yourself and you attach to that person. And for those of you that are wondering what love bombing is, it's where you, at the beginning of a relationship, bombard the person with loving words, loving messages, photos, constant contact. You're telling them and promising them the world. You're throwing yourself at them, basically, and telling them that you want to have this great life with them, that they're the best thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to be with them straight away, forever. Love bombing is where affection and commitment are intense and immediate. And this can be a red flag for unhealthy dynamics. It can also be showing you that you have got insecurities, that you maybe need to work on your self-esteem, that you're looking for love and security in other people to validate yourself, maybe because there's a void there. So work on yourself, focus on your personal growth, your healing. The healthier you become, the more likely you are to attract healthier partners. That's something that is so true with everyone I work with and all of my relationship experiences. I attract people on the same emotional level as me. We attract people who are like us on the same emotional level, often going through the same emotional challenges, sometimes even the same emotions. You can attract someone that has inner anger issues, are angry at themselves, or low confidence. It's like a mirror. We're attracting people who have the same things that we are going through, which can be such a blessing, because if you realize this and you embark on a journey to grow and heal together, that can be absolutely profound, having a partner to grow and heal with. The problem is when people get stuck. They get stuck in these self-abandonment patterns. Their partner's also stuck. They enable each other. They reinforce these patterns, and then they become stronger and they become less conscious. David made a pact with himself that he was not going to get into a relationship with anyone that needed fixing. That first he was going to fix anything that he felt he needed to in himself, and only get into relationships with women who were emotionally present, who were supportive, who were self-reliant, that they could provide for themselves and look after themselves. David also joined a hiking club, an activity which helped him build confidence, meet new people outside of the romantic context. By recognizing and addressing this pattern, people can learn to form healthier relationships that are based on mutual emotional support, emotional availability, rather than repeating familiar patterns of abandonment from the past. And okay, sometimes in this case, it can come from previous adult relationship experiences. I have worked with many people who have a really solid, amazing childhood where they're loved, they're seen, their emotional needs are met, their physical needs are met. They were popular at school. They were well-liked. They felt comfortable about the way that they looked and in their body. They had all of that. And then they got into a relationship with someone and it brought them down. And then they continued in a negative relationship pattern, which created these self-abandonment patterns. So it doesn't have to come just from childhood. So the journey to healing from the wounds of abandonment fundamentally involves learning to stop abandoning yourself and recognizing that your childhood experiences were not your fault. It's important to understand that you didn't choose the circumstances of your childhood. Even if you love your parents deeply, I hope you do. It's natural to feel a mix of emotions like anger, sadness, guilt, and fear. These feelings are valid and part of the healing process. This isn't about bashing parents. The work that I do with people isn't about saying, well, they were wrong and they shouldn't have done this and they shouldn't have done that. It's recognizing that they were doing the best that they could. My mum was doing the best that she could with the emotional resources that she had at that time. She was deeply wounded by her own personal struggles in childhood of losing her mum to cancer at 16 and watching her die for many years before that, and then becoming responsible for looking after her brothers and her dad and taking care of the household responsibilities. So she didn't have anyone that was emotionally available for her. She wasn't held and loved and encouraged. She wasn't seen. She wasn't able to express her anger, her sadness, her fears, her hurt. She stuffed it down. And as a result, she was highly anxious, paranoid, depressed, aggressive. And in those times, she was so scared that if she went to get help for the way that she was, we would be taken away from her. She was so scared of losing us children that she didn't go to the doctors until she was 60 years old. And then she got diagnosed bipolar. Despite her emotional and physical abuse, when I look at her, I see that little girl in her. She's changed now. She's a loving, supportive, caring mum. I couldn't ask for more. She's got a great sense of humor. She's so more relaxed now that us children are grown up and she doesn't have to work. She's retired. She's now 70. So the journey is about understanding your childhood coping mechanisms, beginning on working on them, building a foundation of self-love and inner strength. This process is about providing yourself with the support, techniques, and love that you may not have received in your childhood. Recognizing your worthiness is a vital step in this journey. Understanding that healing is not simply about checking boxes. It's a lifelong commitment. I've been at it for over 20 years and it gets better and the layers get lifted and there's more layers. However, it's just an amazing path to be on because life just gets better and better and better the more you clear the cobwebs of the past. Because these behaviors of self-abandonment are so deeply ingrained, please do find someone that can do some deeper work with you. You need someone that's going to help you release them from your body, from your mind, from your heart, because that's where they came from. They come from our body. And they came from a time before we even had the words to express what we were feeling. They're rooted in the attachment patterns that we develop with our parents from birth and influenced by our environment and our genetics. To stop abandoning yourself, it's important to embrace strategies that support your healing and growth. Remember that you are worthy of not being abandoned. And who you are is important to the world. But first, you need to see and believe in your own worth and take the necessary steps for care and for nurturing yourself. These 10 habits that I've spoken to are a great starting point for awareness. You deserve a place in this world. And by ceasing to abandon yourself, you can start to fill that space with a true and healed version of who you are. If you want to fast track this process of healing your abandonment wounds, break through those self-abandonment patterns, then I have my breakthrough program, which covers the 3 main steps to breaking free from self-abandonment. So you can really thrive and your relationships can be really fulfilling. The program comes with 3-month support as it takes time to build new neural circuits. In the breakthrough process, we will release the beliefs that don't serve you. We clear those repressed, stuck emotions. We will then build healthy neural pathways by you taking consistent action in loving yourself, building confidence and trust in yourself so that you can engage with the world in a completely different way. That's a lot of information. So in order to understand it more, I've created a breakthrough masterclass video that you can watch where you can understand more deeply the steps you can take, whether it's with me or with somebody else, because I can't work with everyone. It will guide you into the steps that you can take to heal and to free yourself from the fear of abandonment, from these self-abandonment patterns that, if not addressed, can end up taking over your whole life, can end up being your whole life experience, which is such a shame. So you can check out that Breakthrough Masterclass video. Also, I've created the Self-Empowerment Toolkit, totally free, loads of different activities and exercises to do to build yourself up. I really hope that you enjoy that. I'd love to hear how you get on using the Self-Empowerment Toolkit. And I'm also now working with plant medicine. So if you're interested in finding out more about those retreats and working with me in person, then don't hesitate to contact me and ask for more information. Before we wrap up today, I just want to say how grateful I am for all of you listeners out there. It's such an honor and a pleasure to connect with you in this way. And for those that join my Facebook group or connect with me on social media or on other platforms, it's lovely to be in this community of freedom seekers who want to grow, who want to heal, who want to better themselves, who want to be the best version of themselves so that they can have truly deep, fulfilling relationships, inspire and help others. From my heart to yours, take amazing care of yourself. As the Buddha says, and I'll end with that quote again, you yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection.
Dear listeners, today I celebrate you. You are among the few who actively nurture their love journey. It's an act of courage, an act of self-love. And if today's episode resonated with you, be a beacon for others. Subscribe, rate, and review. Let's spread this love and wisdom far and wide. Craving more? Discover the free resources at nicolabeer.com. You can also find the links to helpful gifts in the show notes. Do also join our Relationship and Wellness Facebook group. It's a haven where we uplift, support, and journey together towards richer, deeper love stories. Remember, you have the power to craft the love story you deserve. Thank you for being with me today. And until next time, keep shining and loving with all your heart.